come on in and spend some time with the film hobbyist. My name is Lydia, and I love movies. We're sitting here in my attic room. I'm in an old desk chair with cracks in the pleather lining. You're sitting on a forest green Walmart futon with a black metal frame. It's not the most comfortable seat in the world, but it has a history. I've watched a lot of movies there. Sorry if it's a bit chilly up here. The insulation isn't great. You can reach for that granny square blanket if you get cold. Since this is your first visit, I've thought a lot about which movie to talk about. I know that you can tell a lot about someone from their movies. I'm one of those people who comes over and spends half the time looking at shelves. What books do you have crammed in, layer on layer? What Blu-rays are next to the TV? What games? And I've decided that as good a movie as any to introduce myself and how I see movies is Steven Spielberg's 1981 classic, Raiders of the Lost Ark. This is one of those movies so ubiquitous that even if you haven't seen it, you've seen something from it. It's often parodied. Its iconography is repurposed and reused. It practically defines the adventure genre. And I think it's a perfect film. Now, what do I mean by a perfect film? First of all, I mean a film that exhibits a fully executed vision. The writers, the directors, the production team, the actors, the composers, all of them worked together to create a single unified whole without a weak link. If I were to rate the craftsmanship of this film, I would have to give it 5 stars. You might disagree. That's fine. But that's how I see it. I'm not saying this film is important art. Far from that. If I were to rate the thematic significance of this film, I'd give it 1 star. This film is pure fluff, and that's not a bad thing. This film is a 1930s adventure serial. It's good guys versus bad guys. It's archetype and thrill and excitement. It isn't interested in the finer points of colonialism or the moral dubiousness of grave robbing. It isn't interested in sexual ethics either. It doesn't need to be. This movie is here to take you on a ride, and I think it does that with excellence. I love this movie. I've watched it more times than I can count. I came to it a little bit later than some. I've always had a low tolerance for scares. If you choose to come back and visit, you'll find I have a complicated relationship with horror movies. As in, I'm very interested in them, but I can't actually watch very many. And so I didn't watch this movie until I was probably 12. Even then, I don't think I watched the finale of this movie with my eyes open until I was much older. But we had a copy of it on VHS recorded off TV. And we had one of those chunky portable TVs with a VCR attached. And I know that the summer I was 16 was particularly difficult for teenage drama reasons. So I spent a lot of time hiding in my room, alternating between watching a particular BBC miniseries and this movie. Again, I don't know how many times I watched it, but it was a lot. So why? It isn't just the excellent craftsmanship, the story and acting choices, the music and stunts, the set pieces. And it certainly isn't the excellent brainlessness of this movie. My personal rankings have so much to do with the feeling a film gives me, the way I connect with it and thrill over it. And I think there are 2 big factors for why I love this movie so much. I really connect with the adventure genre. A hero or a group of people coming together to accomplish a task or to find something in the midst of an exciting landscape just scratches an itch. But it isn't the plotty nature or the found family or the romance that stands out. It's the atmosphere. It's the presence of the sublime. The sublime is an aesthetic principle largely outlined by British and German philosophers in the 18th century. I'm sorry if this is all a bit pretentious. I learned about it in college in my literature classes. It's sort of a foil to beauty, its darker cousin. Beauty is associated with peace, with rest. It's a sunny day in a field of flowers, the birds singing while a brook chirps. It's symmetry and order. The sublime is danger and excitement. It's thunderstorms and tumultuous seas, a steep mountain path lost in the fog. It's fascinating ugliness, the attraction of chaos, and I love it. The 19th century romantics were obsessed with the sublime, and their works paved the way for most of modern speculative fiction, fantasy, sci-fi, horror, and yes, adventure. The sublime is a feeling, thrill, excitement, awe. And I think Raiders of the Lost Ark revels in the sublime. John Williams' score does a lot of work, but you can't discount Douglas Slocum's cinematography, the way he captures how light falls through trees in the jungle, or the many shadows Indy finds himself emerging from. And most of all, the direction of Steven Spielberg. This film drips with atmosphere. It's in the decision to follow Indy and Shadow, the pacing of the temple heist in the beginning. It's that moment Marion pulls out the medallion and the candle splutters, sparking in her eyes. It's the decision to open the Well of Souls under thunder and lightning, which, a thunderstorm in the middle of the desert where no rain actually falls, that's the kind of thing you do just for atmosphere. It's the ponderous camera movements, how it pulls slowly over the floor of snakes, or the sunlight shining down on the staff of Ra in the map room. And Raiders of the Lost Ark follows the sublime to its natural conclusions. Its supernatural conclusions, actually. It's there in the aesthetic choices, yes, but it also translates to the story itself. George Lucas and Philip Kaufman smartly let the story fall away from a world of pure reason into the world of sublime supernaturality. The modern world of adventure films takes supernaturality as a given, but it wasn't necessarily that way before Raiders. The most influential adventure stories took an air of scientific explanation for its credulity-stretching hijinks. Jules Verne's stories, for example, or Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan. It isn't magic that makes Tarzan be able to speak ape. It's a fudged sort of science, assuming that animals can communicate with each other in their own way. Now, there was magic of a sort in pre-indie adventure stories, but to talk about them, we actually do have to address one of those pesky thematic ideas that Raiders of the Lost Ark isn't particularly interested in, and that's colonialism. The adventure genre exists because of colonialism. And that makes me kind of sad. I really like adventure stories. But the whole premise of the genre is that there are unexplored places of our world, hidden corners that contain lost cities or civilizations of untold riches and secret knowledge. Unexplored by whom? Hidden from whom? And clearly, the civilizations exist. So it isn't them. They clearly don't count as people the same way our protagonists do. There's a kind of manifest destiny to adventure stories, that white people lay some claim to every corner of the world. And although some push back and concede that maybe there are corners that can't be conquered, but in both of these, we have to acknowledge the idea of othering. There are other people who aren't white Westerners, and they are either savage monsters or exotic angels, something more than human. And magic is wrapped up in all of that. They have primitive religions and beliefs, and in some stories, those beliefs turn out to be true. A good deal of Egypt-based stories fall into that category. But in others, these savage monsters or exotic beauties are easily won over by science, the conquering truth of Western civilization. We see this in the cold open of Raiders, how Indy understands that the spiritual beliefs about the temple are just there to hide well-constructed booby traps, and how Belloc uses the superstitions of the natives to rob them blind. But what's interesting is that the Ark isn't a made-up thing from an invented religion practiced by savages. It's a backbone of ancient Jewish tradition. And three out of four of the storytellers here, Spielberg, Kaufman, and screenwriter Lawrence Kasdan, are Jewish. The lost artifact here with genuine power comes straight out of Sunday school. And it's Jewish spiritual power that conquers the scientific Nazis who assume they can bulldoze the desert for a weapon they can control. As a lover of the adventure genre and someone who cares about thematic conversations this movie isn't overtly engaged in, it's a real relief to see the supernatural divorced a little from othering colonialism and allowing that the colonizing Nazis are literally melted by their attempts to own the world. It's also a big reason why I'm very much not a fan of Temple of Doom, which is gross in its cultural depictions of all kinds, and a piece of why I prefer The Last Crusade, relying on Christian-adjacent mythologies of the Holy Grail, even though I have to admit that the Crusades were one big attempt at colonization. All that to say that the supernatural experience stuff is pure sublime. It's this dark, dangerous thing we can't understand. The idea of lost and hidden artifacts, of the specific mystery to be uncovered, that spine-tingling thrill of discovery, or that which cannot be discovered, all of that is the sublime. And the climax of this film is not a fight or a chase or even an action set piece. It's the opening of the Ark and the discovery of the dangerous, alluring, unknowable power inside. Indy survives by respecting the sublime, by bowing to it, and allowing himself enough awe to shut his eyes, while we, the audience, get the full, darkly glorious, face-melting spectacle. Science doesn't win. Reason doesn't win. Beauty and peace and order do not win. Chaos wins. And the best we can do is box it up and not touch it. I said there were two big factors for why Raiders of the Lost Ark is one of my favorite movies. And the second is the one, the only Marion Ravenwood. I don't think this movie works without her. And I think you can look at the other two classic indie movies and know exactly what's missing. Part of the legend of this film is that Steven Spielberg wanted to make a James Bond movie, and this was pitched to him by George Lucas as being the closest he could get as an American. A grand trope of the James Bond film is the Bond girl, which usually comes in one of two flavors. She's either a convenient bombshell Bond seduces along the way, or she's a femme fatale come to seduce him to destroy him. There is a third category of hot and skillful babe whom Bond wins over. Modern Bond girls often go this direction, which really just makes her an update of Flavor One. Marion is almost the last kind, except she very much isn't. She's much closer to the plucky young woman trope, usually seen in detective novels. A young woman, often boyish at heart, who assists the older detective in his work. She isn't the most skilled, but she has viv and pep and moxie. In those stories, the detective isn't romantically interested in the plucky young woman. She's more likely to have an age-appropriate sweetheart. So you can see the limits here, but Marion is a character designed to stand on her own two feet. Yes, it is weird that she and Indy had a relationship 10 years before the movie. She refers to that age as being a child, though Karen Allen was 30 when she played the role, so that does get us closer to the age of consent than George Lucas's original idea. Ugh. But I appreciate that Marion is in control of every part of her relationship with Indy. When Indy first walks through her door, He gives her a charming smile, while Marion gives him a classic smooth speech about his appearance, and then she sucker punches him. We see her rage throw her a little off kilter as she tries to dismiss the past, but she's not conceding any ground about what he did to her. He tries to ask about the headpiece, dismissing its significance and offering her a wad of cash. Marion doesn't give him the piece, even though she's literally wearing it. She tells him to come back tomorrow. It's Marion who insists on coming with Indy to see the quest through. When she finds herself kidnapped and discovers Indy won't rescue her, she uses her high drinking tolerance to escape, which would have worked if not for the convenient appearance of Tote. While she is helpless in the Well of Souls, she initially refuses Indy's offer to carry her. Her yells of fear are comical, unlike Kate Capshaw's incessant screams in the sequel. While she ends up trapped in the plane later and must be rescued by Indy, she ends up there because she knocks out the pilot to save Indy and gets stuck in the plane so she can use the guns to, again, rescue him. When Indy and Marion do have a romantic scene, Indy is bruised and injured and whimpering, and Marion is the one who does the seducing. She is the one in control. And that's cool. Marion is a character who challenges Indy at every turn. Yeah, she sometimes makes life more difficult for him, but she also talks to him like an equal. She's smart and scrappy and ready for a challenge. Again, one of the reasons Temple of Doom fails as a sequel is that there isn't anyone to match Indy like this. Willy is a mess, and while Short Round rules, he is a child. His bravado crumbles. And while that might bring pathos, it means that Indy's character suffers as a result. A huge reason why The Last Crusade is a close second to Raiders is that Henry Jones Sr. is another character who matches and challenges Indy as an equal. That dynamic, that taking down a peg of Indy, that refusal to let him fully be a James Bond-level mythic hero makes the good Indy films stand out. Of course, Marion isn't just a scrappy girl with swagger. The Nepal sequence gives us a girl with layers. Yes, she can drink a man under the table. Yes, she runs a bar and has a level of authority. Yes, she has female rage against Indy and her dad and scoffs at their archaeological loves. But then we get to see Marion alone. Before the adventure, before the danger, Marion gets a wordless scene. This MacGuffin of a medallion really mattered to her dad. It was his life's work. And yeah, he dragged her all across the world and left her stranded in Nepal. But she carries that medallion around her neck. It matters to her. She pulls it out, her large eyes glassy with awe and feeling. You can see her love for her dad there, all that childhood belief buried under layers of cynicism. And then she looks at the cash in her hand. There's a way out. She looks conflicted. She looks back at the medallion, apologetic. Then she looks back at the cash and grins, hanging up the medallion. In this short scene, absolutely filled with the sublime, by the way, we understand Marion's wounds. Her understanding of the situation, despite her insistence to the contrary, and her absolute drive to survive and escape. While Marion is beautiful, she defies being a sex symbol. While she is wily, she also gets to be goofy. While she is petty, she is also serious. Marion is not a Bond girl. She's a delightfully rounded character, complicated, but also at home in the broadness of the adventure genre. It's a character that makes me feel seen, and one that makes me wish for an entirely different set of Indy sequels, ones where she gets to be a co-adventurer with Indy, where he isn't James Bond, and they are somehow a dysfunctional team. And maybe that's a big part of why I watched this film countless times the summer I was 16, longing to escape to a world where women are more than some man's fantasy, one filled with thunder and sudden gusts of wind and spluttering torches, with awe and danger and wonder. A perfect film. The kind that I can use to introduce myself and how I see movies. Thanks for coming.